Blog Talk Radio.
This is Movie Geeks United. We have a packed show tonight, packed with goodness. We have actor Chaz Palminteri as he discusses his new film, Yonkers Joe. Actor Christopher Carley goes toe-to-toe with Clint Eastwood in Gran Torino. Writer-director Sterling Harjo brings his Barking Water to Sundance. And the Palm Springs International Film Festival premieres An Unlikely Weapon from Susan Morgan Cooper. And the Globes are just around the corner. It's an exciting night here on Movie Geeks United. Let's get right to it. To the big show this Sunday evening. Hope everyone out there is having a great weekend. Jerry, how are you doing?
I am doing very well. How are you?
I am doing fine.
Well, that's good to hear.
You go out to see any movies this weekend?
I've been watching a lot of stuff on DVD this weekend. A lot of stuff, actually. I watched a French horror film, Inside. I watched a Japanese movie, Blood and Bones, and I watched a Argentinian movie, The Aura, which is directed by the late director Fabian Belansky, who did Nine Queens. I don't know if you've heard of that movie from the earlier part of this decade. Does it ring a bell?
I've seen a movie called Nine Queens before. I don't think it's the same one.
Yeah, it's the same one, and this is his second film. He died a couple of years ago. I want to say he had a heart attack, but this is a second or third film he had directed. And it was pretty good. It had the an actor that he uses in a lot of his films, and it was a very good crime film. And the Blood and Bones had Beat DeCassie in it, and that was from 2004, but I just discovered it on Netflix. I've been looking for it for a long time, so that's what
Netflix is great for that, man.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, that's the whole reason why I joined Netflix, not to get anything that I can get down the street at the Blockbuster, but you know, for the specialty titles and all the old Criterion titles. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's great for that. So, yeah, that's where I fell in love with Kurosawa. I just ordered everything Netflix had of
right.
Kurosawa.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great service. I went out to the theater. I saw Gran Torino again with a large audience. Obviously, it was the number one film in the country this weekend.
And it deserves to be. I'm so glad that the two horror films, Bride Wars and The Unborn, were not. I did see The Unborn,
right.
But I...
You
it
did
wasn't
see
a,
it?
I did see it. I saw it because Gary Oldman as a rabbi is a very enticing...
Right.
But I'm very impressed with the cast. There are a lot of people who have given it a great review. There are parts of the film you just want to burst out laughing. You know, it's an interesting idea that they use the basis of the film comes from the twins experiment that Dr. Mengele did at Auschwitz. So it's
right.
an interesting idea, and it's directed by David Goyer, who wrote The Dark Knight, Dark City, Batman Begins. But it's just his directing films are horribly executed. This and The Invisible, you don't know whether to laugh or just cry during parts of it.
Right. I was going to go see it, and I chose to see the Eastwood movie with an audience.
I wish I would have gone again. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah. Because my brother's a big, and his son, they're big horror movie fanatics, so they go out every horror movie every weekend to go. So speaking of horror movies every weekend, My Bloody Valentine 3D, which actually... I would very much like to see.
I wish
in
that was playing
in 3D.
Instead.
Yeah.
I wish.
that kind of geeks me out, going to see a movie, a horror movie in 3D. That opens this upcoming weekend, and we have the cinematographer and the composer on Wednesday night.
That should be an awesome show. I also just like Todd Farmer, the screenwriter, is going to be on tomorrow night on tomorrow night is the first episode of Horror Yearbooks podcast on Blog Talk Radio at 10 o'clock. Will and Molly will be doing a weekly show, and Todd Farmer will be the first guest on, and that's tomorrow night at 10 o'clock.
Yeah. It's this. I saw watching football today. I saw some advertisements for this, and that. So it's the word's out there about this movie, and
I think it's pretty
exciting.
Smart to do it in 3D.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I haven't been to a 3D film as of late. I didn't go see Bolt in 3D or whatever else has been in 3D. So I don't know what the new technology is like.
I'm very curious.
Yeah. You haven't seen. You didn't see.
I saw Bolt, but I did not. Unfortunately, my theater did not have it in 3D when it was.
Right.
I got the 2D version. So.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of Bolt, Travolta's backed out of the Golden Globes tonight, for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But Bolt is up for a couple of awards tonight, at the Golden Globes. And looking at that picture. Not the picture Bolt, but looking at the Golden Globes picture, you know, some things have changed. Some dynamics have kind of changed since we did our initial roundtable prediction show following the nominations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the main thing that has changed is that Slumdog is now has the momentum and the goodwill.
Oh, it does.
To go all the way.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Yeah,
and
this wasn't necessarily
too.
What's that, man?
It's good. Well, just with the Guild Awards that have come out in the last week, the Producers Guild, the Directors Guild,
right?
And you just see Slumdog and Danny Boyle up there. So I definitely think, it's looking like this could be the year that the little movie is the one that goes all the way.
Yeah, the audience favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's interesting how the tides kind of change in this,
mm-hmm.
and you don't know what's responsible for it, but there's a shift in perception for some of these movies. It happens every year, and it can change from one week to the next. It's just something in the air, and you can feel it, you know? And Slumdog is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And then the reaction to the film Milk is another one of those, which is a fine film, but I don't think it is considered a favorite to win.
No, but I am surprised. That it had.
Yeah.
I think it's a very good film, but I am surprised that, you know, after the Globes and some of the other awards, that all of a sudden this film is starting to like crop up again. I was surprised by that.
What are you the most excited about seeing with the Globes this year? An actual show that's
well,
exciting.
That's the first thing. And what do you mean when I'm not watching, trying to watch what Jack Bauer is up to for during the first half?
Sure. Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. I had to say that because I am excited to see what seems to be could be a good season of 24.
Yeah, I'm TiVoing that, and I'm TiVoing Big Love next weekend. That's what I'm looking forward to next weekend.
I knew that you were going to say that. For me, it's Battlestar on Friday night. That's what I'm really looking forward to. But
you can take
anything,
that.
What?
I'll take my Mormons.
I know,
you want
the Well, you know, it's really funny you say that. The original Battlestar Galactica that was on when we were kids is for that one season is considered a metaphor for Mormonism. So,
well, there you go. Everything
so
ties in.
There is a correlation there. What I'm looking forward to tonight, there's talk that James Franco could win for Best Actor for Best Comedy.
Right, right.
And I'm curious to see if that would really happen.
Well, it can happen at the Globes. That's the good thing about the Globes.
It's not going to happen at the Globes.
No. It can happen at the Globes, and that's what's so wonderful about the Globes. You can talk about the cheese factor of the, you know, of all these award shows, really. But the fact that they do single out comedies that are as deserving as any of the dramas, you know, they're not elitists in that sense. In that,
not at all.
Yeah, and we talked about this. There's some great nominees this year, and some surprising inclusions that I'm very happy about with this year's nominees. So I like award shows. I look forward to seeing Salma Hayek again. She's mm-hmm. going to be there tonight.
We all do.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest,
I mean, what is an award show without Salma Hayek on the
exactly.
red carpet? I'm there. Yeah. Did you see the Broadcast Film Critics Awards on Thursday?
I did not watch them. I saw the results, but I did not watch them. What did I miss?
A couple of things. The biggest thing was Sean Penn winning Best Actor. And so it showed all the nominees, and they included Brad Pitt and Mickey Rourke, of course. Sean Penn wins. Everybody gives him a standing O. And Mickey Rourke's up there on his feet, too, standing and applauding.
Mm-hmm.
And Sean Penn walks up, and he says, I admire all the people I was nominated with immensely. I'm big fans of all of you. Just keep in mind that I'm only up here because ultimately this is a beauty contest. To which Brad Pitt just started dying laughing. So that was a highlight. And Slumdog, of course, just a big sweeper.
I really think that's where it's going, I think that's great. If it goes that way, more power to it.
Yeah. And Dakota Fanning walked up. And she is now in the teenage phase. I mean, she is now becoming a woman.
Do you want to say that on the air? Do you really want to have this?
No, she is. It's amazing because it's when you so identify them at a certain age, and
mm-hmm.
Haley Joel Osment the same. And now she's in that phase where she's no longer the little girl actress.
Right.
She's an amazing talent, but
she
kind of looked like. She kind of looked like a Charlie's Angel, like walking up to the podium.
I will say this: she was very good. I thought I didn't think it was a great film, but I thought some of the performances in The Secret Lives of Bees,
right?
You know, she was good in that. Alicia Keys was good in that. But you know, she's definitely with each performance coming into her own.
Yeah, yeah. What's the blonde Charlie's Angel? Not Farrah Fawcett, but the other one, the Lad? No, not Lad.
No, not
Cheryl Ladd. Yeah,
Cheryl
Ladd.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I see. That's who she reminded me of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And especially when she held the gun and she did that pose, the
right,
profile
right.
pose. Yeah. I don't know where
Diane,
that came from.
Diane Ladd as a Charlie's Angel. That's hysterical.
Yeah, the wild at heart Diane Ladd.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty sure she would be the one to blow up Bosley if she was play the character in Wild at Heart. That's a great performance.
That is. That's a great. No. That is probably on here, though. Honestly, that's probably one of the most important films you've ever seen.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
That's a
crazy
watershed film. Watershed film for you.
Yeah. And wasn't she Oscar nominated for that? That
oh,
was
she
the
was.
Nomination. Yeah. Yeah. So Wild at Heart was up for an Oscar. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was excited by that. I remember that year because they were on the red carpet and Nicholson, they actually pulled Nicholson aside and got a brief interview with him, which he always tends to try to avoid. And they said, what do you think of the nominees? And he said something to the effect of, there's a lot of performances that aren't recognized, like Willem Dafoe, I thought, did amazing work in Wild at Heart this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, God, I love Nicholson.
Yeah.
I mean, that's even more reason to love
him.
He
was great. No, he was very good as Bobby Peru. That was,
yeah.
That's just a great, that movie gets better each time I watch it.
Yeah, and better in its flaws, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's all part of that, the flaws, they don't matter because it's all part of that crazy stew
mm-hmm.
that Lynch cooks up.
Yeah.
You know? The movie is so, it's everything. It's so all across the board, and that's what the movie's about, that sense of abandon.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say enough about Wild Heart.
Criterion's
like
got to make that a DVD.
I think so, but you know, they came out with a David Lynch green box that has many of his movies,
mm-hmm.
many extras, many discs full of extras, including 32 deleted scenes from Wild at Heart.
32?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Because if you recall, there was a lot of controversy over Wild at Heart upon its release because of the violence quotient, and
mm-hmm.
and there's a, I guess there's an abortion scene that went too far.
Yeah.
There's three things in that movie. There's the Bobby Peru his death.
Yes, yes. I can't forget that.
The Johnny Farragut death mm-hmm. was apparently too unbearable. It went too far. and the Laura Dern, Diane Ladd abortion clinic scene where apparently the mother was waving a lollipop to her, to Laura Dern as she was having the procedure done in typical Twisted Lynch fashion.
Right, right.
You know, the crazy movie. I got to invest in that box. I got to see
what's
going on.
Yeah, I'm thinking the same thing as we're speaking here.
yeah. Okay, so we're excited about the Golden Globes tonight. I'm sure we'll have something to say about it Wednesday night when we come back on. Mm-hmm. We have great guests Wednesday night, as we mentioned before. Tonight we have a great lineup of guests, so let's get right to our first guest. This is an exciting interview, brief as it was, but it was an honor to have the opportunity to speak with him. Oscar-nominated actor Chaz Palminteri has always been a powerful and authentic presence on screen. Performances in great films like The Usual Suspects, Bullets Over Broadway, and Analyze This has cemented his position in the lexicon of great, tough New York actors. He broke through with a filmed adaptation of his hit play, A Bronx Tale, which he recently revived on the Broadway stage, playing dozens of characters. And actually, that production is currently touring the country. It's going to be in my neck of the woods in February, so I might try to catch that and check that out. That would be good. Other recent films include Robert Davi's The Dukes and Once More with Feeling, which will premiere later this month at Sundance. In this conversation, we discuss his criteria for choosing roles, the independent film movement, and his new film, Yonkers Joe, in which he plays a casino con man who struggles through a strained relationship with his mentally disabled son. So here is Chaz.
On a four?
Swing shift, table six. They're going in and out. Look, they're out again.
Go. You've been made.
What are you talking about?
Would you come with us, please? You too, sir?
Were you cheating?
What?
Where's the dice?
I don't have any dice.
Get the hell out of here and don't come back.
Well, we could take them off at the crap den.
The casino?
They're marking the dice. Could you get me any of that stuff?
Blacklight Joe.
Joe knows every angle.
Ace is full.
Yeah, pretty good, my friend.
Gotta keep your eyes on me. I'm a little fair.
He always has a move.
It's a good switch, but where's the leak where you can see the other dice in your hand?
There is no other dice.
I mean, I'm looking right at him. I don't see anything.
To make the dice roll his way.
Hello.
You need to come pick up your son.
But life is more complicated than dice.
Joe Dumas, the winner!
He turns 21 in 3 weeks. He's got to move on.
I spoke to the woman. She told me about this place that for kids like this. It's very expensive. That's why we got to make this score, Janice.
Just let me go home.
Don't you think I would if I could? I'm not going to turn my back on you.
Now, he's not only raising the stakes.
I say we make a move or we can grab the most money, and that's Vegas.
Security in Vegas is 10 times tougher.
Your dad has got a set, let me tell you.
He's raising the son.
I love you, Dad.
I am going to help this kid right now.
The perfect score.
Listen, I came up with something. Grab the dice with an open hand. I'm going to whip it fast. We got about 8 or 10 rolls before the heat comes down, so every bet counts.
An unlikely team.
Could you take a blow? What happened to him?
He has caught every bad break a human being could catch, including me for a father. Right or wrong, he's part of something. He's part of this.
And the man at the heart of it all.
Let's go.
Academy Award nominee Chaz Palminteri, Academy Award nominee Christine Lotti, Thomas Guiry, Linus Roach, and Academy Award nominee Michael Lerner.
Joe Duma, the winner!
Viva Las Vegas!
Yonkers Joe.
I loved Yonkers Joe. I thought it was just a beautiful movie.
Oh, well, thanks
and
a lot.
I'm wondering, when you read it, the script, the first time, what about it struck you and made you want to commit to it?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a really good story. You know, I read it and I just said, wow, you know, you read a lot of scripts, you get offered movies, and most of them probably are 60-70% written, and you go, oh my God, we'll fix it in pre-production, but this was pretty much done when I read it. I only had a few notes about it, but so when you get a really good script with a good story, I just jumped right on and I said, okay, I'll get involved in this.
Yeah, and it's got great, obviously great writing attracts great actors.
Right.
It has that, and it has wonderful characters, but it seems to come from a real authentic voice.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that writer-director.
Well, the writer-director, Bob Celestino, and you're absolutely right, you hit it right on the head. His father was Yonkers Joe. You know, so he really, obviously, he lived and breathed, you know, his father's words and what his father, you know, taught him. And so it's a pretty incredible story. And he has a nephew who has Down syndrome. So he kind of put both stories together, you know, which I thought was a wonderful idea. You know, here am I trying to make a big score to get rid of my son. And it's actually trying to get rid of my son as I learn how to love my son.
Right.
You know, and it's almost like the boy redeems the father and the father redeems the boy. And I thought it was brilliantly constructed, and it's really a great story for special need parents and special need children. I talk to a lot of these people, and because when I did my research, besides the gambling, I did my research with the special needs people, and I spoke to a lot of parents, and they always said how special these kids really are, and the joy that it brings to them, and some of the parents I spoke to. With single parents, they broke up because of the special need kids. So it was really interesting how certain parents were able to handle it and certain parents were not able to handle it. Actually, it cost them their divorce, you know. So there was this feeling of loneliness with Yonkers that I wanted to have, and that self-persecution that it could have been his fault, and that I really got from a lot of these people, which really helped me a lot.
I would think from these ideas and these elements coming so closely from his life, that spending time with the director and really having an open form of communication with him during the process was even more important for this project.
Well, without a doubt. I mean, because it was Bob's father, I was able to ask him, well, how was it when he did this? And when your father was, how old when he did, and when you would talk with him, what was his feeling about this?
Mm-hmm.
When people asked him what he did for a living, what did he say? I mean, you know, this was his father. His father was a hustler, you know. So it was great. It was great to have him there. Plus, I met with this guy, Fast Jack, who was his partner. And he's in his, like, 70s, late 70s now. And I talked with him, and so he was a great help, too. You know, so it really, I had this incredible venue of people that I could go to. So it helped me a great deal. And that's the voice that you picked up, that honesty voice.
Yeah, it very much is, and I was looking forward to a very entertaining kind of casino heist kind of film. I didn't expect it to be so emotionally involving and there would be such an investment there. It was a very nice surprise, this film was. We had the pleasure of speaking a couple of months ago on this show for about a full hour with Robert Davi.
Yes, I remember that. Sure,
it was wonderful, and that's another film, The Dukes, that feels like a labor of love.
Yes,
much like this one.
Yeah, exactly. Robert wrote and directed that, and you know, I enjoy working with first-time directors. I enjoy working with independent filmmakers because you know, they take chances. You know, and that's what I like.
And that's what I was wondering, as opposed to your basic big studio project on an independent film. From a actor standpoint, when you're crafting a performance, is there any kind of different dynamic at play? Is it helpful or indifferent?
Well, usually the script is just different. You know, most of the big movies, they're always worried about not offending a certain demographic, and the stars are, certain stars are there for the wrong reasons, not because they're perfect for the part, but because they're more of a box office than a name, you know. But independent, it's all about the work. It's nothing but all about the work.
Yeah.
And that's what I like about the independent films. Because anybody who's doing independent movies, you're not making a lot of money. So, you know, it's really, they're there to want it. They really want to be there. And it's really a labor of love. And that's what I love about it.
I asked you at the top about your decision to do this movie and what went into that. Has your decisions, your criteria for choosing a role changed or evolved throughout your career?
That's a good question. No, that's a very good question. I don't know. Yes, in a way, I try to do more roles that I'm going to be. I feel like the movie could be really good. You know, I read a script and I go, well, okay, it's a good script. And okay, who's directing it? Okay, I take a meeting with the director. Wow, he seems confident and he has passion. Okay, that's good. Who else is in it and who's producing it? if all those answers are yes, I go, well, we got a shot for something good to happen here. A shot. Now, it's not definite now, but at least you have a shot. But I, you know, have I done some movies where I knew right away going into it that, forget it, this movie's not, you know, who's going to see this movie? You know, I'm not sure. And, you know, it was more of a risk and or more of a money job. Has that happened to me a few times? Yeah. Now I really just try to do movies that I'm very proud of. You know, Guide to Recognizing Your Saints and, you know, and Yonkish Joe. And I've just done another one called Once More with Feeling. That just got accepted at the Sundance.
Oh, wow.
At the Sundance Film Festival. And it's a wonderful film, and I'll be going up there to support that. So, you know, I love films that are labeled love. You know, The Dukes, all these films.
Yeah.
And look, sometimes they make money, sometimes they don't. But that's not my – I can't control that. All I do is try to do good work. That's all I do.
And you are. And I think you should be very proud of the work you've been doing in these films. And I know you're pressed for time, so I'll let you go. But let me just tell you, thank you so much for the work that you've done. And we're big admirers of you on the show. And please come back to us anytime.
Anytime. I appreciate that. And thank you very much. God bless. Thank you.
Yeah, Chaz Palminteri. The new film is Yonkers Joe. It's currently playing on demand on your cable network, and it's playing in New York and L.A. theaters as well. And
that was
it's a good,
awesome
it's,
interview. Great
it's
interview.
A really good film.
Cool.
I mean, he's a really nice guy. Surprisingly soft-spoken.
That surprised me too.
A voice that calms you. And judging from some of the characters that he plays, that's the last thing you expect.
Right. Yeah.
He's a great presence on screen. He's just he has that movie star charisma just
yes,
kind of plugged in. And there's a sense among some people that he's on a path now where he's doing these, like we discussed, these independent projects. And some people are saying, you know, where did he go? He used to be in these big movies. But
mm-hmm.
if you think about it, first of all, Bronx Tale was an indie film.
It was.
Usual Suspects. Nobody expected Usual Suspects to become
mm-hmm.
Usual Suspects. But secondly, he's doing great character work, probably the most interesting character work that he's done in his career. At this stage in his career,
right.
With these indie films,
he's very good in Bullets Over Broadway too.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of the great Woody Allen films.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, absolutely. We're moments away. Actually, let's go ahead and get to this. Our next interview. This is a good conversation. You and I both liked Gran Torino, and it opened wide this weekend. So I trust
yes, it
that
did.
A lot more people out there have had the opportunity to check it out, the new Eastwood film. And so we're excited about this next interview. Actor Christopher Carley has appeared in several great television series like The Sopranos, House, and Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which I miss that show. Do you miss that show?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. I mean, I love The West Wing, but did you watch that first season of Studio 60?
I watched a couple episodes, not a lot of them, but I did watch a couple.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It was, you know, it was missed. It's unfair because they were both doing, because I guess 30 Rock won out, but
but to pair Matthew Perry with Bradley Whitford,
yeah,
that was irresistible. They're both so great.
Mm-hmm.
Without a doubt, though, Mr. Carley's the highlight of his young professional career thus far has to be his featured role in Clint Eastwood's new film Gran Torino. Playing the priest who struggles to lead Eastwood's grouchy, world-weary Walt Kowalski to some level of salvation. Carley goes one-on-one with a cinematic legend in several standout scenes. And we spoke to Carley earlier this week about the entire Eastwood experience and a whole lot more. So here is that conversation.
Tao and Sue are never going to find peace in this world as long as that gang's around. Until they go away, you know, forever.
What are you saying?
You know what I'm saying.
They took Sue to the hospital. She's scared. They're all scared.
Yeah.
Tao especially. He's sitting out there right now staring at your front door. You know what he expects, Mr. Kowalski.
What would you do? What should Tao do?
I know what I would do if I was you. Or at least what you think you should do.
Really?
If I was Tao, I guess I'd want vengeance. I want to stand shoulder to shoulder with you and kill those guys.
And you?
What would I do? I'd come over here and talk to you, I guess. So what are you going to do, Mr. Kowalski?
Did this part in Gran Torino come to you through the usual kind of avenue, through an audition process?
Yeah, just the regular sort of channels. My agent, got me the appointment, so I got the script and read it, and I went in and auditioned. And quite honestly, initially when I read it, I assumed that they'd be making offers out to stars and bigger names, which,
right.
I found out further down the line that they were. So I was just looking at it as really an opportunity to meet Ellen Chenoweth, the casting director, and figured that it would be great if I got far enough down the line where Clint Eastwood would look at me and say, well, I like this kid, but we need somebody with more of a name. So, yeah, I went in and I read one scene once, and then 2 days later read another scene twice, and that was as far as the auditioning went.
Oh, wow. And so after that stage of the game, you were hired on, and you hadn't even met Eastwood at that point?
No. I mean, it didn't happen that quickly, but as far as I never met him in the audition. I only read for Ellen Chenoweth and the casting director, and with her and her casting associate, Jeff. And they sent the tapes to him, and then it was sort of weeks and weeks of kind of checking in with my agent and hearing that I was, still on the list, but there were still people that they were seeing, and I was doing what any actor who's been in the business long enough kind of does, is sort of, prepare themselves for the day when they
right.
call and they say they really loved you, but it's not going to go any further. And then when they called and told me I was cast, that was a nice change of pace.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
So tell me about that first meeting with Eastwood. Talk about intimidating. This is one of the legends.
Well, I had assumed that, even though he cast off tape, which makes sense to me, I had assumed that he would want to meet me before we started shooting. But there was no, after the couple days and, weeks passed by that between getting cast and shooting, and I wasn't getting any phone calls of like, well, this is when we're all going to sit around and have a chat, I called and asked my manager to see if he could give me a phone call. And so he actually called me the day before I was supposed to fly to Detroit.
Oh, wow.
So, and I had all these sort of questions in my head about sort of motivation and specificity and kind of, where he sort of wanted the character to go. And the end result being is that since he waited so long to call me back because he was, taking a break in between The Changeling and, who knows, the other 15 films he's working on now before
right,
he started on
right.
Gran Torino, most of the sort of questions I had sort of answered myself. And so when he called me up, it was kind of, he was chatting a little bit about his character and, answered the sort of specific questions that I had, but I had so few at that point. So basically his character sort of conversation with me was, do what you did on the tape. I liked what
right.
you did on the tape. And different
right.
variations of just come in and do what you did on the tape. That's why I hired you, because I liked what you did on the tape. So I showed up in Detroit and then did what I did on the tape.
Well, you've done movies and you've done several really high profile television series as well. So you have experience working with a variety of directors. But
yeah.
from everything that I've heard, Eastwood is kind of he's a world apart in that he's very no nonsense. Just get down to it. Do it. Once or twice, was that your experience with him, just a no-nonsense approach?
Yeah, definitively. The only thing is that I feel like the no-nonsense thing kind of implies that there's some sort of sort of like tension on set. Like you show up and he's like, listen, let's do it once and don't screw
right.
up. But like I said to people, which I think is kind of the greatest
the greatest environment that any actor could work in. I was saying to friends of mine, it had the same level of tension after the first day that I remember rehearsing high school plays. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was in high school and it was like, well, of course I'm going to get cast and of course I'm going to have a good role. And the director is, you know, my high school teacher. And there was no sort of sense of tension about it. I mean, he and his crew have worked together for so long that they're all so good at what they do. And there's absolutely no ego and no sense of status at all on set. Everybody just kind of shows up and does their job, and they all, you know, Clint's obviously in charge, but there's no, normally when you show up on a set, a lot of times the first experience that you have is you meet a couple people, and then somebody's coming over to you and kind of making it clear that they're the one that's the most important, or that they're the boss, and they want to let you know that you should feel lucky to be there because you're kind of the one that doesn't belong. And although, you know, admittedly, as an actor, a lot of times that's in your own head. A lot of times it's really directly coming from people. And when you walk onto the set with him, and people had told me this, it's very calm, it's very quiet, and everybody's very friendly, and everybody's very nice, and there's really nothing that would ever in any way, even to the sense of noise level, get in the way of you being able to focus and do your job.
Yeah.
You know?
That's got to be really, great. Got to be great for a performer, just that level of relaxation.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, as an actor, you know, like you said, I mean, I've done work, and I've worked with other sort of notable people, but never, you know, I've never worked with anybody that's as big a movie star or, an icon as him, so I couldn't imagine having to go into the largest film role that I've ever had with an actor, director who's that level of kind of, you know, notoriety in the world, let alone somebody that I'm a big fan of, and not have that environment and have to deal with, oh, man, he's got a bad attitude, or, you know, he's yelling at me all the time, or he seems like he's having a bad day, so he's taking it out on me. I mean, I couldn't imagine being able to work in that environment, you know? So it was nice to know when I got there that wasn't going to be the case, and then everything else that happened was better than I had expected, which I don't know how that could be because nobody has a bad thing to say about him.
No, I haven't heard anything. Now, tell me, you talked about preparing the character beforehand. I'm wondering your take on the character. For me, one thing that strikes me about him is that he is definitely a part of this community, and he's realistic about the dangerous elements in the community as well that he serves.
Yeah, I think, I mean, my take on the character is that, you know, from the scenes in the movie, you can see that there aren't all that many Hmong people at the church, obviously because they're not Christian, you know. But I think that he is very, very involved in the community in that sense. And as you know, and all I really have is what's from the script to go from. As you know, a couple lines in the script, he says, you know, I do work with some of the gangs in the neighborhood. So I think he has probably a better understanding of them as a community than most of the white people in the neighborhood, and certainly a lot better than Walt does at the beginning of the film.
Right.
But
right.
You know, as far as obviously, you know, most if not all of my scenes in the movie are with Walt, you know, Clint's character. And I looked at it as sort of each one of the scenes is kind of his new tactic on how he thinks he's going to break through and how he's going to get him to go to confession. I mean, his ultimate goal in the movie is to get him to go to confession at the at the beginning of the film. And I feel like every time as an actor, you know, that I showed up for a scene or on that day, you know, to do one of my many scenes where he's slamming a door in my face or telling me, you know, in nice or not so nice ways to F off, that each one was kind of like, all right, what's my tactic today? And what do I think is the new sort of little bit of light that I can kind of throw on this that's going to get him to break?
Right.
And, you know, sometimes that's me showing, you know, that's the character showing up angry, you know, and figuring, well, if I just, you know, if I show him how pissed I am, then, you know, then maybe that'll have a tactic. And, you know, then obviously as the film progresses, I kind of realize that he's probably not going to be intimidated by me. So maybe I should try a different way. I've tried the friendly way. I've tried the intimidating way. So maybe I should go back and educate myself as much as I can on him, you know, as I have uh-huh. with religion. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. This interests me too. And I don't know if you had discussions with Mr. Eastwood on this or not. Obviously, this and Million Dollar Baby are from two different screenwriters. But I think kind of a similar approach to the religious figures in both of them, in that Mr. Eastwood's characters in both films seem at first very cautious and skeptical about the church, but in the end, it's a necessary path you have to explore. Were there conversations on how religion figures into these themes in this film in particular?
No, not really. Well, first of all, an interesting kind of anecdote is that the actor Brian O'Byrne, who plays the priest in Million Dollar Baby, is kind of like one of the patron saints of my career. He and another actress years ago were responsible for getting me my first audition for my first job, which was a sort of strange kind of roundabout. And the other actress is Amy Ryan, who was in The Changeling. And so it was
a
strange
fantastic.
Sort of circle that came full circle where I'm like, wait, I'm playing a priest. Breen played a priest in Million Dollar Baby, and Amy Ryan was in The Changeling, you know. It was sort of strange.
Wow.
But anyway, as far as, there wasn't really any discussion about any of the typical things that you would sort of think, you know, or past experience or, you know, any of the sort of regular kind of, you know, quote-unquote experiences that I've had, there were none of those conversations about motivation or, you know, or themes or any of that stuff. It was kind of all falls into sort of his way of working. I mean, I'm sure if I had questions for him, you know, that would be, that he'd ask them. But, you know, the general understanding is that you kind of show up and do it. So there's not much conversation about how these scenes fit into the whole. You know,
right.
He's obviously thinking of that as the director, but he doesn't really get involved with you unless you're doing something that's completely and totally off the mark. You know, Steve Campanelli, who's the A camera guy in the movie, said, you know, to me one day, if he's talking to you, there's a problem. You know, if he's having long, extensive conversations about what's going on in the scene, it means it's because he's not getting what he wants.
Right.
So that's something a little strange to adjust to as an actor, because you're there for a couple days and he's not really saying anything to you except, okay, moving on. And so you start thinking, oh, man, am I going to get fired here? You know what I mean? Then you realize, oh, well, he's not saying anything to you because he likes what you're doing. And, you know, furthermore, he's not discussing character and motivation because he's not really concerned with that as long as what he's seeing in front of him is providing that. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure. Did you always want to act? Was this your first memory of something you wanted to do with your life? Was it acting?
When I was a young kid, I wanted to be a baker or a chef.
Oh.
I liked making my grandmother's Irish soda bread and cooking. But I guess a friend of mine made me audition for Guys and Dolls when I was in seventh grade, and you know, I got cast as Nathan, who I didn't even know was lead until the first day of rehearsal. And ever since seventh grade, I've kind of been hooked. Yeah.
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 And you've had some success on stage as well. I know you've been in some Broadway productions, and is that something that you, no matter how your career in film progresses, that stage is something that you want to remain close to?
Yeah. I mean, just for the... just for the purely kind of selfish reasons of there's just nothing that feels better than being on stage. There's nothing more fun as an actor. But also, I think, you know, career-wise and kind of in the bigger picture, it's kind of like going to the gym. You know, it's mm-hmm. the way that you stay in shape. And I sometimes worry. I mean, I lived in New York up until 2 years ago, and oh, sorry, that's my dog.
Oh, that's all right.
I lived in New York up until 2 years ago, and now I've moved out here to L.A., and I did a play out here, but I haven't done a play now in a little over a year, and every time I'm away from theater for too long, I kind of think, am I getting rusty? Am I not going to be able to act from the neck down anymore? Because that's where I started, and that's what I know, so that's what kind of feels... That's what kind of feels the most real to me, because it's almost, in a lot of ways, it's still the most familiar, you know?
Yeah. That's I know a lot of people, that feel that way about stage work, and they say exactly what you did to exercise those muscles again, so you don't feel like you're getting rusty. Tell me about, you talked to me a little bit about being directed by Eastwood, but mm-hmm. when you're acting across from Eastwood as an actor, what does he give to you?
He gives you there's no sense that he's the director at that point, which is really great, which is sort of another concern I've had, because I've never acted across from somebody who's also directing, obviously never in theater, because that's not really possible, but but even on film, I've never acted with the director. And the good thing about it is that you don't really ever have the sense that he's the director when you're acting with him, because he's there with you. You know, he's not looking at a monitor and just sort of reading his lines in. He doesn't use a stand-in to say his lines or anything like that. So the great thing is that when you're in the scenes with him, you do have him at 100% to bounce off of. So it's not you're not acting with 50% lead actor of the movie and 50% director and producer. You know what I mean?
Sure,
He's right there with you. So
I just can't imagine for any actor, no matter how experienced, to be in the theater, because I'm sure you attended the premiere of this and you probably have seen it with audiences too. I would think. To be in a theater and watch yourself on screen, sharing a scene opposite Clint Eastwood, do you pinch yourself? Can you get your head around that at all?
Well, luckily, by the time I had seen it at the premiere with an audience, you know, of people that knew I was there, and there was some kind of press around, I had seen two screenings of it. So by the time I had seen it at the premiere, the nausea had sort of subsided, and the sort of the panic of, you know, as my mother said, she's watching the movie and she really loves the movie, but it took her a while to get over, you know, the points in her head where she's going, when does Christopher come back? When does he come back on the screen?
Right.
And I have quite the opposite experience. My scenes are over and I go, oh, good, great. Now I can just watch him and B and him and, you know, the other actors in the movie and those scenes. So by the time I got to the premiere, that was such a surreal experience that it was almost distracting enough that I could enjoy it. But then a couple weeks later, when I was in New York, I went to see it with my parents and my two sisters, my wife and my brother-in-law. And we just went to a theater in New York in Union Square and sat in the back row. And I think that was the first time that I was actually able to really enjoy it, because it was as close as I think I'll ever be able to get to being objective and say, oh, I actually like this movie. And, you know, I believe the work that I'm doing as much as I can believe it, because if I believed it, I'd kind of be insane, because I know it's not real, because I remember creating those moments, you know?
Right.
So it's sort of a cycle of kind of like nausea to acceptance to like, oh, I'm not that terrible, because I think it's a thing that you have to adjust to as an actor, knowing if what you see on screen is you don't have a reaction of, oh my God, what am I doing? That is absolutely horrific. Then it has to be, then it might just be okay. You know what I mean?
Right. But I've also heard from people that say it's difficult to separate when you're watching scenes of yourself in a film, it's difficult to separate. That's what this day was like. That's what that day of shooting was like. That's what we're doing on this day. To separate the film from the experience of actually doing it. And I'm wondering, as you watch the movie, as opposed to doing it, were there things that surprised you about what showed up on screen? Were there moments that you had that you weren't aware of having created at all?
No, that's the sort of strange thing about this whole process, because in the best way, there's almost no there was almost no mystery or surprise element to it, because the script that I read and the scenes that I got, you know, I got scenes from that script and auditioned for it. That was when I asked for the shooting script. It was the exact same script. The only difference was that there were shot descriptions in it. And my understanding is that that script was the actual first draft, and there were no changes made to it. And that continued from the casting process all the way through the shooting process, in the sense that he shoots so few takes that there's not really room for you to say, oh, I can't remember which take that was, because a lot of times he's only doing one take, or he's doing one, you know, he's doing two or three, or, like, you know, on a crazy day he'll do four in one setup. So there's not much room, because he doesn't shoot it 15 different ways and then decide what he wants in the editing room. He shoots it the way that he wants it, and the crew around him knows what he wants. So they're like a kind of, it's like a group of jazz musicians that all sort of, you know, are clicking like a clock. So you don't, there's not much variance in the day when you're shooting. So when you see the movie, it was pretty much exactly what I expected, because from what I remember from the movie, I think there's only one scene that's in the script that is missing, and the movie's stronger for it, you know what I mean? But it's pretty much exactly what was in the script is exactly what we shot and is exactly what you saw in front of you, which was a nice experience to have that be a positive thing, instead of going, oh, nothing's happened, nothing's changed.
Yeah, man, that's enough to spoil an actor, though, because that's the rare, that has to be the rarity.
I want to
tell
retire
me about,
like Gene Hackman, but I guess I have a couple more things that I have to do to get to that status.
In terms of acting, is there a main influence for you? Is there someone's career that you kind of emulate more than any other?
Is there someone's career that I emulate? Wow, that's a tough one. Maybe because they're far enough down the line, you know, as far as people like Clint who have directed and acted and produced, and people like George Clooney who are directing and acting, and that, you know, those are people that are really impressive to me, because I feel like I'm at a point now where I feel pretty confident about what I can do on stage. I'm feeling more and more confident about where I am in film and TV, and sort of, you know, kind of getting to a point, you know, like wanting to get to a point where I feel completely confident about that, which I don't think will really ever happen, and I'm kind of happy about that. But it's amazing to me, because I feel like that keeps you hungry, and a little bit of sort of fear and a little bit of a sense of you never really know what you're doing, I think, kind of keeps you sharp. But it's amazing to me the people that can handle all different, like, be behind the camera, in front of the camera, producing and writing all at the same time. That's pretty impressive to me, just to sort of be able to kind of handle them all well on that, you know, on that scale, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wish you the very best of luck, and this is a great performance and a great movie. You've got to be thrilled about it, and you're welcome back anytime you'd like.
Well, thanks, Jamie. I've set up your podcast for a subscription, so I'll be listening to you.
Oh, thank you, man. I appreciate it, Christopher.
All right.
Take care.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a good day.
That's Christopher Carley from Gran Torino. It opened this weekend. Lots of people went to see it. And he subscribed to our podcast.
That's awesome. And, you know, that's really just beautiful.
That shoots him right up to the top. In my book.
Come back every week. That
puts him right over the top. This is a big audience favorite, Gran Torino. Watching it in a packed house, which, by my understanding, talking to several people in different sections of the country, that's how everyone saw Gran Torino this weekend, in packed houses. I actually, stepping out of it, there was a long holding line for the next show of it. And, you know, don't underestimate the power of Clint Eastwood, particularly if he's acting in a film.
When he's in front of the camera, when he's acting, you know, that's a big draw. And I saw it a couple of weeks ago in a packed house, and, you know, people responded to it very favorably. And it sounds like, you know, from what you're saying and what my mom and my brother's saying, people just love the film, and rightfully so. It's an incredible film. It really is.
Yeah. It's he's a powerful career. I mean, there's no career like his, really.
He is. He's in a class by himself. He's really, you know, he, like everyone else, has had his ups and downs, but the ups are, there are more ups and downs, though, I have to say. And like,
Oh, yeah.
And he's just an incredible, I mean, he's a guy, and he says, you know, I love every aspect of the business, and it shows. He loves, you know, he does the music, he does, you know, he directs, he writes, he acts, I mean, produces. He loves every part of the industry.
You know what it is, what I think it is, he's never not been beloved among fans of films and just as a personality, and yet he isn't afraid to do risky, oftentimes politically incorrect so-called works, you know, and yet he is still so beloved. It's such a part of his persona that he can do that, you know.
Absolutely.
He has that kind of gravitas about him. And you know what it is? He's the real deal.
He is.
And people know that. You sense that right away.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a word we've used several times tonight, which is authentic.
He is authentic.
You can't get more authentic than Clint Eastwood. I mean,
no, you cannot. You really can't.
Speaking of another great actor, Chris told me something. He's left the chat room. But he told me something a couple of days ago. He saw that there's a new documentary about John Cazale.
Wow.
Yes.
When now? Is this a brand new documentary? Is this?
Yes. He said he saw a poster online for it, and so I'm dying to know more information about that.
Oh, yeah. That would definitely be worthwhile talking about and watching. Obviously,
yeah.
Guy
who was
in
you,
all the important movies.
Really, and you're talking about, we talked about the longevity of Eastwood's career and how amazing that one is. Cazale, as an actor, probably has the greatest resume of any actor that's ever lived.
Yeah,
he only made 5 movies.
Yeah.
But among those 5 were The Godfather, The Godfather 2, Dog Day Afternoon, Deer Hunter. I mean, come on.
And Meryl Streep took care of him, you know.
Yeah,
he had
in his last
bone
days.
Cancer, and she took care of him. So
yeah, but how heartbreaking is Fredo?
It is very heartbreaking.
And then in Dog Day, you know, obviously, so he and Pacino had a real bond as well. But that's a documentary project that really excites me.
Oh yeah, I didn't know anything about it, so that's incredible.
Yeah, because it's one of those, they need to be brought into the vernacular again, that great work that he did.
You know, the Deer Hunter is Mickey Rourke's favorite movie of all time.
I would imagine it is.
Yeah.
I would imagine it is simply because of his affinity for Cimino, which he certainly has an affinity for
Cimino. He does.
Cimino.
I mean, Cimino, yeah, without a doubt.
excuse me. I can't get over this cold, man. It lingers.
You sound a lot better than you did last week, though.
Well, thank you. I think I sound sexy with a cold. I think I'll keep it.
Yeah, great. Okay, but no, you do sound a lot better, buddy. It's going around. Everyone has it, so.
Yeah, I get it every January, like clockwork. Happy New Year, Jamie. Here's a bronchial infection.
God. Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
Yeah, that's great. Our next guest is on the line. And let's get right to it. This is great. This is a very good film. Writer-director Sterling Harjo. I want to say Sterling Hayden.
I wanted to say that all day. So
yeah, but what a great name. I mean, he's extraordinarily talented, Sterling Harjo. But just with that name alone, I mean, he's a star director. I think that puts him in right there. He has a wonderful new film titled Barking Water, which enjoys its premiere at Sundance next Saturday. But this isn't the first time this exciting and accomplished filmmaker has been to Sundance. The prestigious festival premiered his short film Goodnight, Irene, and his feature film script Four Sheets to the Wind was shepherded through the Sundance Institute's Filmmaker Labs. And it was one of 12 out of more than 2,500 projects chosen that year. So that's a real honor. That film went on to receive a special jury prize for its lead performance. And his new film, Barking Water, is a soulful experience, a really heartfelt examination of the memories and the people we hold most dear as our lives draw to a close. It's a great pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Sterling Harjo. Mr. Harjo, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks for having me. Welcome.
Thank you so much for being with us. First of all, I'm pronouncing your name correctly. I'm terrible at this. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah, that's correct. Definitely.
Okay.
Well, I usually get Harjo, but it's Harjo.
It's Harjo.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. I love the film, and I want to know about your when the seeds of becoming a filmmaker, having a career in film, first entered your mind, and who were those people that kind of shaped that notion.
Well, I mean, I'm from a small town in Oklahoma called Holdenville, and it's about 5,000 people. And, you know, I mean, we didn't really have, filmmaking was not an option. It was just this thing that, you know, I loved movies as a kid, but, like, it was so far away from me, I never knew that you could actually make them or anything. We actually had a theater in my hometown that is now a church. It was bought, it was, like, sold, and now it's a church. But, and we used to go there every Friday, but it wasn't until, and I always wanted to be a painter and artist. That's what sort of I grew up doing. My dad was a pretty good artist, and he never really went anywhere with it, so I was really encouraged by my family to sort of pursue it. And so once I got to college, I went to the University of Oklahoma as a painting major, and you know, once I was there, like, there were like three films that came out. I remember it was like American Beauty, Smoke Signals, and Good Will Hunting. And you know, they're not my favorite films in the world. I loved them when they came out. But, like, the thing that they really – that struck me was how personal they were. All of a sudden, it was like these – you know, like, I felt like the people that were making these films were real. And I knew, like, what kind of people they were by the story. And they were also regional, in a sense. And so all of a sudden, I started thinking, like, oh, well, maybe, you know, I could write stories about where I'm from and people could be interested in them. And so – and then I took an intro to film class, and it was at that point that I really just fell in love and changed my major. And I just I'd written short stories before and stuff, but you know, I just started writing scripts.
So you're always creative. You always have that creative spark. I'm interested in two things about you on the outset here. Your Native American heritage. What role does that play for you in terms of your choices of stories and themes that you want to explore?
Well, you know, I mean, it's funny because I have, the three films that I've made, including my short film, they're, you know, about Native people. And at the same time, I never really, like, in my films, I never try to focus on the fact that they're Native people in the films, you know? Like, I just want to tell stories and sort of about certain types of people where I'm from, which is a specific sort of region, I think. I mean, like, Oklahoma was, you know, Oklahoma means land of the red man and Choctaw, and it was, you know, at one time Indian territory. I think there's, like, 32 tribes here right now. And so where I'm from, it's Seminole and Creek, and that's what tribes that I belong to. That definitely influences all the stuff that I do. At the same time, I have I don't just want to make films about Native people, you know. I have stories that I've written that aren't about Native people, but, you know, for one reason or another, those are harder to get made, I guess. It's sort of like people – kind of put you in that thing of, oh, this is a guy that does Native work, you know, like. So
I understand. You shouldn't be pigeonholed at all, and I didn't mean to infer that with the question. But it is curious to me because, first of all, you've spoken to living in Oklahoma, and Oklahoma, at least, I don't know what it's like now, but it's never been known as a filmmaking kind of mecca. And the Native American filmmaking community, I don't even know if there really is one. So
not too many.
Yeah. So how do you? What is your sense of that? And how did you especially the region that you live in? How did you kind of overcome that, and are there the resources there where you in Oklahoma to really build a movie?
I mean, really,
like,
I'm
like
here.
This?
I mean, like, my career really took off once Sundance happened, and
right.
I happened to be listening to someone that was speaking at the University of Oklahoma about their labs, and I just talked to them, and I sent my script in, and really that's what did it for me. And I also think that because my stories, you know, I definitely the Native aspects of my stories helped make them stand out, I think, and they were sort of fresh and new, and, you know, you just don't get story
right.
scripts about modern Native Americans every day across your desk, I guess. But the funny thing is, I mean, there is a small community of, and it's sort of this small community of indigenous filmmakers, like we know each other. And at first
mm-hmm.
I really, that's really got on my nerves at first. I was like, oh, I'm just a filmmaker, you know, like I just want to make films. And, you know, we're not all alike. We're from different regions. We're from different tribes. We speak different
right.
languages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's very different. But at the same time, I got to a point and spent enough time with the other filmmakers where I got this sense of pride, and it was like, you know, wow, there's just a handful of us that are doing this, and that is something to be proud of, because, you know, we didn't have access to
mm-hmm.
a lot of equipment and stuff. And, you know, it wasn't until I got into college and I took a loan out and, like, bought a computer and a camera, and I still haven't paid it back, but that's when I started learning how to use the equipment, you know.
Right.
But, you know, so it was like a love-hate thing for me, the whole sort of Native filmmaker thing. Like, at first I really fought against it, and now it's like I'm actually really proud of it.
Yeah, I understand. I can understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Sundance experience, so you had submitted your short film and it got accepted. Was that your first kind of experience with Sundance?
Actually, my first experience was with my script Four Sheets to the Wind, and it was
okay.
a script. I actually lived in New York at the time, and I was writing this script that it was sort of about home, I guess, and so I got into the writer's lab at Sundance, and I think I was like 23. I remember when I found out, I was actually roofing a house with these two like biker guys, and I got the phone call. Well, I remember they were like, we're going to call you at noon today, and so I climbed up the roof and like got down, and I actually didn't have a cell phone at the time. I borrowed my dad's cell phone, and they made the call, and they were like, ah, you're in the Sundance lab, and so it was this big moment, and then I crawled back on the roof and finished, but I forget where I was going with that. Oh, but and so that was the first experience, was the lab with Four Sheets to the Wind. And then after that, I didn't want to jump right into Four Sheets to the Wind because I just didn't have the experience. And I was a little – I wanted to make a short film first just to sort of get my feet wet and get used to everything. And because, I mean, when I went to Sundance, that was the first time that I ever – I really even heard of a script supervisor. The stuff that I'd made before that was like music videos with my buddies, and I made a couple short films, and it was just like me and a friend and a camera. And so when I went to the labs, I really learned what all these different aspects of filmmaking are, and, you know, I learned that you actually do need a script supervisor, and they're very important. And, you know, I just learned so much there. And so after that, I really wanted to make a short film before I jumped into a feature, and so that's when I made a short film called Goodnight Irene that ended up getting into the festival, and it sort of played around the world and won some awards and stuff. So
right.
it was a good
tell
experience.
Me about,
it really helped out.
Tell me about this lab, the intensity of it. What were some of the most valuable kinds of pearls of wisdom you received from your mentors? Who were your mentors? Just tell me about that experience.
Well, the writer's lab, and there's a writer's lab for a week, and then if you get in, you come back to the director's lab, and then you do another week of the writer's lab, and the director's lab is like 3.5 weeks or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I worked with Ed Harris, and one of the head of the director's lab is a guy named Julia Gazdag, who's this Hungarian filmmaker who's just amazing, and I worked with Jim Taylor. And I worked with Walter Mosley and Walter Bernstein and Susan Shilliday. And I remember one of the biggest, the thing that I learned that has affected me the most that I've used, that I can consciously, you know, I'm sure I use a lot of things that I learned there, but the one thing that I know that I'm using and that I see makes a difference is Joan Darling, who is head of the she sort of gives workshops on working with actors.
Mm-hmm.
And some advice that she gave us was, you know, whenever you say cut, before you say anything to anyone else, before you say anything to the cameraman, to anyone else, make sure you say something to the actor first.
Right.
And then the next thing was, you know, if you want to change someone's performance and if they're not doing it right, never do it out loud in front of everyone. If you want to, if they're not doing it right and you want to change that, then, you know, go up and whisper to them or take them aside or whatever. And those two little things, like, have made such a difference in working with actors with me. I mean, like, it, you get trust from actors so quickly by doing
yeah.
that. And to have that trust is so important.
I would think so, especially watching this film. And I can tell that it was a very kind of intimate process with the actors. And so let's talk about Barking Water. First of all, if you could tell our audience what the film is about.
It's about a couple, an older couple, Frankie and Irene. They've sort of been in this, I would say, 40-year on and off relationship. It was pretty tumultuous over the time, over the years. And we sort of, the story picks up when Irene comes back to him one last time. And Frankie is dying in the hospital. And so she comes back to him in this hospital, and the movie starts there. And she breaks him from the hospital. And it's all about her trying to get him home to see his estranged daughter before he dies. And throughout this trip, it's sort of, you know, you sort of learn more about their love and about who they are, and also what went wrong, I think. And a big part is about this man who has to sort of examine the choices that he made in his life, and
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
also sort of reflect on his life.
Sounds heartbreaking.
Yeah,
it's also fun.
No, but I mean that in a good way. I mean that in a good way. It's like a very emotional film, and
yeah.
I mean that in a very good way. Not.
No, it's
but
funny
it
though, because like whenever sometimes when I talk about that, sometimes when I tell people what it's about, I always have to remember it at the end to say, you know, it's also there's some funny moments too,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it sounds pretty heavy.
Right.
Oh yeah, there's lots in there to relate to, and it's a joy following these characters. But it came from, it was inspired by a potentially real life heartbreaking tie with your life with your grandmother, was it?
Yeah, it was my grandma. She had, and you know, I'd had the idea before about someone wanting to leave a hospital, but all of a sudden I found myself in that situation.
Right.
My grandmother, who we're all very close to, got sick, and like she had to be rushed to the hospital, and me and my family went to Oklahoma City, and you know, we're staying with her throughout the week. I actually rode with her in the ambulance to the hospital, and I just remember her being scared, you know, and it was like
right.
this sort of this reality of it, you know, it's like, you know, she's still trying to hold it together and be grandma, but she's also scared and kind of feels like a kid, you know?
Yeah.
And she wrote and she hated the hospital. I mean, she absolutely hated it, and she drove, like, she drove the nurses crazy and stuff. And she dictated a letter to my mom, and it said, and I have the letter that I'm going to post on our website, but the letter basically says, go ahead, sorry. Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Oh,
we're listening.
Okay, and the letter basically said, you know, I don't want to die in the hospital. I don't want to be hooked up to machines. Do not make me live by machines. I want to go home to live out the rest of my days, however long that may be, if things get worse. And it
right.
said, you know, I think it ended with like something like, do not stick any tubes down my throat or tie up my hands. And then she signed it. And she gave it to me and was like, you know, I know that you'll make sure that this happens. Because my mom and my aunts were, you know, they want her to get better, and they're not going to show anyone this thing or whatever. So she was like, I know you'll show them. So she made my mom give me the letter. And all of a sudden, you know, it was like this real situation that I found myself in with my grandmother, who didn't want to be in the hospital. She wanted to go home, you know.
Right.
And no matter, like, how painful or whatever that may be, she wanted to go home. And then, you know, I had also wanted to make a story about an older couple who, you know, because I feel like older couples, they're always sort of treated, you know, things are usually perfect and whatever in
right.
films. And, you know, I just was, I remember thinking, like, I'm sure it's really tough for them, too. They have more experience to deal with it, but I'm sure it's just as, you know, I'm sure it's just as hard for an older couple as it is a young couple.
Sure, yeah.
And as you get older, you realize you're just still the same person. You just, you know, have more years under your belt. And so it's, I sort of just had these two ideas that I wanted to merge these stories together. And because of the personal thing with my grandmother, I felt like before I had this idea of what I wanted to do, and it just wasn't working. But then after I sort of went through that with my grandmother, and she got better, by the way, and she's actually doing really well now. And so, but having
that
experience, that
is
yeah, so having that, and having that experience, it was like very personal to me all of a sudden. I was able to write it after that, I think.
Yeah, but you mentioned the length of these characters, the main character's relationship, and the actors that you have playing Frankie and Irene.
Mm-hmm.
Did they have previous? Did they know each other previously, or did they spend time together establishing
yeah, that's the
a
biggest,
relationship?
That's the biggest thing, I think, is that they, I mean, you know, in Indian communities, you know, like if you're in art, if you're in activism, if you're in anything, you know, you usually know each other, and it's like
mm-hmm.
You're connected somehow. And I'd actually written it for both of them in mind. I'd worked with them previously,
right.
And then once I talked to them about it, it happened that they, you know, were good friends, and they knew each other forever. So they were both, because they're both sort of activists. They're both Native American activists, but I mean, his main thing is he's an artist. Richard Ray Whitman, he's an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And Casey Cam Hornick, she's an environmental activist, and she does a lot of, she raises awareness for environmental issues that are back on the Ponca Indian Reservation in Oklahoma, northern Oklahoma, mm-hmm. where she's from. So,
right, right.
That was the main thing for me, is that they have these passions in their lives. So it isn't acting, you know, and they've lived these colorful, huge lives, and I knew that they would be able to pull from that, you know, and that's really the
yeah.
main reason I wanted to write them in these roles.
But it's also, it also works as kind of a road trip movie, too. And I wanted to know the process of shooting a road trip movie, because I read where your whole approach to this project was kind of non-traditional.
Yeah.
Tell me about that approach and why that was important on this one.
Well, it was one thing I really just wanted to, you know, like, I mean, the best thing about a road trip is you don't know what's going to happen. And that's how I wanted to shoot the film. It was like, I wanted a small crew. We had a larger crew with my last film, and I just felt like creatively I wasn't able to do everything that I wanted to do. So this one I wanted to do the opposite. I wanted a small crew. I talked to a lot of the crew members beforehand. I was like, here's how it's going to be, and they were like, all right, we're down. And so it was basically like, if I wanted to change a scene or if I wanted to make something up, if the actors were improvising, then we were just going to go and we were going to film this trip, you know. And so we shot it in sequence, and a lot of it was just like, let's see what we can discover. And, you know, I had a script and everything, but it was a short script. It was 65 pages, and a lot of it was like, let's just see what we can come up with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to do that, because that's how I did it in college. And it was like, there was something really fun about that. And so
yeah.
I wanted to try to sort of take what I'd learned and apply it to how I used to make movies when I was young, you know. And there was something really exciting about that. And,
I used
non-actors.
Yeah.
And that was really exciting, because I love working with non-actors, but I also like putting them with trained actors, because they sort of keep each other on their toes, and interesting things happen, you know. And my whole family's in the film. It's just like people I know, and I don't think everyone can act. I just think that certain people can act, you know. And,
right.
And
but that really is the setup that you've just described, the process. It really is conducive to a road trip movie. So that really stood out in the film, and it's a great film. It's called Barking Water, and it premieres at Sundance on Saturday. Isn't that its first screening on Saturday?
Yeah, Saturday at 2:15 at the Racket Club. Yeah.
How does that feel? I mean, are you getting nervous yet? How will you be when it gets up to the big day?
You know, it's funny. I didn't think I'd be nervous because I've been there twice before, and I was like, oh, I'm such a pro. And
right.
You know, it's closer. It's like I just find myself getting more and more nervous.
Well, it's exciting, man. It's exciting.
Yeah, it's really exciting. I remember before Four Sheets premiered last year, I was like sick. I was just like a mess. So hopefully, you know, that was my first film, so hopefully it won't be that bad, but I'm sure I'll be a little bit nervous. But it's also really exciting to see, you know, how an audience responds. So
yeah. Will this be the first time it screens for an audience, for a large audience?
Yeah, it'll be the first time it screens for a large audience. I mean, we screened it to small audiences and stuff, but never anything, you know, half as big as 650 people. So, so it should be interesting.
Well, let us know how the screening goes. We welcome you back on the show anytime in the future. And your website, you have a website that you put up for the film. It's a great website, barkingwaterfilm.com. Is that what it is?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, we'll put that in the chat room for everyone. And
cool.
Sterling, thank you so much, buddy. Come back
anytime.
All right,
anytime. Good luck. Good luck.
Cool. Thank you guys a lot.
Thank you, Sterling. Bye bye now.
Bye.
Okay, that's Sterling Harjo. The movie is Barking Water. And as you hear reports back from Sundance, starts on the 15th, so it's right around the corner, 15th through the 25th.
I know. It's coming. Everything's coming up so quickly these days.
Yeah, look for coverage of that film, Barking Water, because he's a Sundance veteran. I mean, he's a young filmmaker, and he's already
young filmmaker. This is the third time, so I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah, it is, and we've covered Sundance pretty well. I mean, even when we didn't attempt to with Chaz. Chaz has a movie in Sundance.
Chaz, yeah. I mean, yeah, everything. I mean, we're doing really well here.
Yeah, yeah. And Slam Dance, we'll talk a little bit about Slam Dance on Wednesday night with a guest, too. The Golden Globe red carpet arrivals are occurring right now. I apologize for people that will listen to this on the archive, and this is old news, but... You know, everybody.
Who's on
Lopez,
the red carpet right now? Who's on the?
Lopez and Mark Anthony are just now walking up on the red carpet.
Okay.
And earlier, I saw Elizabeth Banks and some cast members from True Blood. They interviewed True Blood up for any awards tonight. I don't know.
It might be.
I hope so. I love that show.
It's a good show.
Yeah. That's a lot of fun. And now they're interviewing the Jonas Brothers, so I can stop looking at the screen.
Yeah, that's not me. You know.
What are the Jonas Brothers doing at the Golden Globes?
I don't know.
That's like seeing Steven Seagal at the Oscars, which happened one year. Do you remember that year?
What year was that?
Oh, I don't know.
Nominated for two Golden Globes.
It was the worst year. That's what the year was.
Best series in a drama and best performance by an actress, Anna Paquin. So.
Oh, good.
So yeah, it has two nominations. So.
Great. I love me some True Blood, and they're actually in the middle of shooting the next season, as I understand, so they can premiere it in the summer.
Yeah, they really want to get on top. I mean, HBO really wants, because I think they feel they have some, and they do have a successful show there. So.
It's their biggest show since Sopranos. And then, of course, Curb Your Enthusiasm will be back this year, and who can argue with that?
No one can argue with that. That should be insane.
I saw this great thing, an hour-long interview that Ricky Gervais did with Larry David.
Oh, my God, that must be crazy.
Oh, it was great. It was so much fun to watch. Because they come from a kind of similar comedy. I could tell that Gervais was probably really influenced by Larry David when he did Extras.
I definitely see that.
Especially that second season of Extras. Second season of Extras is all about that lead character being embarrassed and just galvanized show after show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what every Curb Your Enthusiasm is about. That's a great show. We welcome everyone to the show. Thanks so much for tuning in the chat room or on the live feed and on the replay feed. We thank all of our friends on Facebook who have supported the show.
Facebook, MySpace, and Twitter everywhere, yes.
Yes,
everyone.
Twitter. All
I haven't used Twitter yet. I haven't, but we're probably going to go to that next.
Yeah, Twitter. I'm so out of it. It just takes me a long time to figure out what these things are and how to work them. The kids today, man.
The kids today, they're so advanced. I mean, by the time I get on Twitter, it will probably be obsolete. That's how I look at it.
Yeah, get on Twitter. I mean, it sounds like some kind of drug or something. Like you're jonesing for Twitter. I'm on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter. Help my Twitter fix.
It's a medication you take for withdrawals. I don't know. That's what it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
So the Golden Globes are a half hour away. We're awaiting a call from our final guest. This is a great film. I'm excited to discuss tonight. This film really interested me, and we'll get in depth with that in just a little bit. What comes up this upcoming weekend? Are there any good films? My Bloody Valentine,
Notorious, the one about the Notorious B.I.G., which
yes.
has actually gotten some good reviews. I'm very curious about that.
Yeah.
And Defiance is in wide release.
Defiance, yes.
So that should be interesting.
You know what? I looked at the outlook for the next couple of months and the calendar, and there's just not a whole lot that really excites me. I hate to say that. But,
mm-hmm.
And this is going to be a great year for movies, I think, looking at long-term throughout the year. But these are the slow months, aren't they?
They are the slow months. Last January, you had this rarity. You had Cloverfield and Rambo. But this January,
yeah.
I'll take that back, though. I think Taken with Liam Neeson is supposed to be very good. And that's the end of it.
I just saw the preview to that yesterday. That looks like a real strong movie. And actually, if you look on IMDb, if you look at their top searches of the year, Taken is right up there.
Yeah. You have Taken, you have The International and Duplicity with Clive Owen.
Duplicity looks very good.
Yeah, and Watchmen March 6th. So there are some. But I know what you're saying, though. It seems like a lot of bad romantic comedies, though. A lot of bad ones coming for the next couple of weeks.
But the you saw the preview to Duplicity, right?
Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
Tony Gilroy,
yeah.
Clive Owen, Julia Roberts,
mm-hmm.
Romantic espionage. I mean, who could beat that?
Yeah, I mean, Tom Wilkinson's in it. Who else is in it? Who's the other? Paul Giamatti's in it too.
Right.
So I think that's actually one. That and Watchmen are really for me like two of the big ones that I'm looking forward to.
I'm sure Watchmen will be huge. I'm sure they'll settle. What's going on?
Oh yeah,
prior to them.
That the rumor has it that will be settled this week. But here's the thing, though. Supposedly, I had read, and I haven't read the graphic novel in a long time, but I have heard that Zack Snyder did admit that he changed the ending. Not drastically, but enough that if it doesn't work, I mean, if he messes this up, the fans are going to be.
Right.
You know, this is like the holy grail of graphic novels, and if he messes this up, he'll never hear the end of it.
Right. Educate me. Is this a graphic novel, a series?
It's a graphic novel. It is the graphic novel. How should we say? He didn't change what the story is. It takes place, I believe, in 1985. Richard Nixon is still president.
In 1985?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. We're a police state. The Cold War is still, you know, going on. It's crazy. It's insane.
Okay.
But I'd have to go back. I mean, I haven't. It's been so long since I've read it.
But people are very protective of.
Oh, they are. Oh, the fans of this one. And as Poland 626 just told me, the new ending is supposed to be better. But to put this in perspective, Alan Moore, who did V for Vendetta, From Hell, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and as soon as I think this was announced, it was going to be made into a movie. Has had his name taken off once again. He just wants nothing to do with it. So.
Well, I don't understand. I mean, I'm not familiar with all the ins and outs of this Watchmen debacle. I don't know how you can make a movie that large, and it only comes out now that they didn't have the rights to make.
Lloyd Levin, I read his letter that was posted on Ain't It Cool News, and he said that when 20th Century Fox was offered or whatever the thing was, they wanted no part in it. They weren't interested. They passed on it when this was going to be made into a movie. And it's only, I guess, since The Dark Knight became so big that they're like, oh, my God, we want in on this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, I don't know.
And it comes from Zack Snyder, and he's really being built up as a great adrenaline young visionary filmmaker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean 300. I like 300. I didn't think it was like reinventing the wheel, but I enjoyed it for what it was. And the remake of Dawn of the Dead was one of the few remakes I could stomach. So
yeah.
I had a really poor choice of words there.
Hang on, I'm gonna choke. Hang on.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Okay. But I see it. I'm very curious to how this is going to turn out as a film.
Now, was 300, was that last year's, last March's, no, last March was the BC.
10,000 BC was, last March.
Right, they wanted
so this
that
is 2 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, they wanted that to be the 2008 300.
No such luck.
Yeah, that didn't work out.
No.
I think it'll work out with Watchmen.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting how trends, they set trends, you know, with March is now a place where they feel like every March they can come out with a big tentpole
mm-hmm.
picture that would usually be reserved for a summer.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, does it start with V for Vendetta a couple of years ago, or?
It might have. It might
okay.
have. Yeah, it may have. I knew that V for Vendetta was a successful movie. I didn't know whether or not it would consider a smash kind of
mm-hmm.
blockbuster
right.
as 300 was. But, you know, summer became a trend. Summer used to be the dumping ground.
Yeah, and then Jaws, and it was Jaws.
Yeah.
Star Wars changed everything.
Yeah, and we can't imagine summer not having this personality.
Mm-hmm.
That
That's right.
Now. Yeah, but at one point... summer was the dead zone.
Yeah, I know.
And Spielberg and Lucas changed that, as they did so many things. Revolutionary Road. Those actors are on the red carpet now, and I'm wondering, is that going to? Well, Kate Winslet's getting a lot of talk about the Reader as well as Revolutionary Road.
Yeah. How do you think this is going to? How do you think he's going to play it? I actually, the more I think about it, I like her more in The Reader than I do Revolutionary Road, but I'm really sort of aiming for Penelope Cruz for Vicky Cristina Barcelona for supporting.
Right.
And it seems like all the energy is aimed at Anne Hathaway for Rachel getting married.
For actress.
Yeah, for best actress. So I don't... Yeah, they should have given it to... Kate for Little Children. That's all I'm going to say. I mean, she was really deserving that year.
Yeah, as was the movie.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I don't know. We'll see what happens tonight. And, you know, like I said, if you have this two-week window and then before the Oscar nominations, and that's when anything can happen. I mean,
right.
I'm very curious. But I do think Kate Winslet is a double nominee for the Oscars, regardless.
I think so, too. And I personally think that this is her year. I think that she's...
One or the other, I mean...
As young as she is and as often as she's been nominated, she's highly accomplished.
She is.
I think this is her year.
I think so, too.
Now, Revolutionary Road is the kind of labor of love that she shepherded
mm-hmm.
for a long time. But The Reader, when she was interviewed about both of the films, she said The Reader was particularly challenging for her.
It's
because
a
she
challenging
had no point
film.
Of, she had no point of identification with this... character.
It is a hard film, but I think of the performances, there is a scene in The Reader with a judge that is very reminiscent of the emotion, the intensity of a couple scenes in Little Children, and I would think The Reader is where I'm thinking that maybe that's where it's going to fall. That's what personally, just for me, of the two performances, they're both performances are very challenging, and they're both very challenging films. But I think The Reader, maybe, she is the strength, I think, of that film. So she might get recognized for that.
It's just, and our next guest is on the line, and I can't wait to speak to her. Let me just say, it's baffling to me how, what is considered a supporting performance.
Oh yeah, she's the core of the film. So I mean,
yes, that's just odd. It's just so she could be nominated in two categories,
mm-hmm.
and not dominate.
Right.
Yeah, dominate one category. All right, our closing segment tonight is going to be we're going to discuss a great, great movie. Eddie Adams was one of the great photographers of our time. If you don't know his name, you certainly know his images, including the haunting and defining image from the Vietnam War known as the Saigon Execution, a shot that was truly seen, felt, and heard around the world. Ironically, this iconic image has haunted Eddie Adams throughout his entire life and career. In the new documentary, An Unlikely Weapon, The Story of Eddie Adams, director Susan Morgan Cooper explores the circumstances surrounding this photo and the remainder of Adams' extraordinary work. Here's a little taste of the film.
Eddie Adams photographed 13 wars, 6 American presidents, and every major film star over the last 50 years. History would be changed through his lens.
Pictures are very important because people believe photographs, and the picture could be a lie. But that person, like we will, we'll look at that, and it's real. It becomes real. It becomes a real thing. You know, they say in the written word, bullshit. The picture is what does it.
Please welcome to the show a great filmmaker, Susan Morgan Cooper. Susan, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hello. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
I love this movie, and I knew that I would love it as soon as I read about it. I'm fascinated by photographers, and particularly war photographers, which Eddie was certainly much more than that, but he was one of the great war photographers. And I'm wondering, how did you first encounter this story and embark on this project?
Well, it's sort of ironic because I've always had a fascination for war photographers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, men who go into the middle of a combat zone and literally lay down their lives to bring us back the story because, you know, a journalist can write about something, but a photographer has to be right there in the line of fire.
Right.
And about 10 years ago, I made a short film called Stringers about a photographer in Vietnam, and I actually used Eddie Adams' pictures as the work of my photographer.
Mm.
And it was thus, you know, ironic that 10 years later, I'm sitting at home on a Saturday night like a major loser, and the phone rings. And it's a friend of mine who owns an Italian restaurant down the road, and he says, Susanna, there's a woman here, she want to make a documentary, eh? And it was Eddie Adams' sister-in-law, who became my co-producer, Cindy Lou Atkins. And I flew to New York to meet with Eddie, and we hit it off amazingly, and that's how the movie began.
Well, first of all, let me say that all of us here on the show, we stay at home by ourselves on Saturday night, too, so you're not a loser.
Oh, well, that's good.
Well, not all the time, but you know, just
occasionally we let Jerry out.
Yeah, we do let him out, except unless it's a full moon, then they keep me in the basement. But
right.
I was just curious, have you ever seen the documentary that came out several years ago, War Photographer?
Oh, yes, about
isn't
James
that a
McAvoy.
Wonderful film? I it's such an addicting story. His story is so addicting and just so engrossing.
It was haunting, and I think with that film especially, you got the feeling that the man carried the weight of the world on his shoulders. And
especially the Israeli sequences. I was just in light of the recent month that we've had. That's all I could think about was that film.
Yes, and I draw a parallel to Eddie because I know that he felt a certain heaviness, you know, because you see so much despair, so many people displaced by war, so
mm-hmm.
many people dismembered, you know, dead. It's sorrowful, and you have these images in your mind, and I'm sure these photographers, you know, feel very weighty and
mm-hmm.
heavy inside.
Yeah, but it is, what makes a great war photographer? You know, obviously Eddie, he shot some defining images of several conflicts, several wars. Is it a matter of luck would certainly have to play a big part, being at the right place at the right time, even though I'm sure there's a skill to that.
In this particular picture, the Saigon execution, the photographs that defined him and won him a Pulitzer and brought him great fame, it actually was shot in 1/500th of a second.
Wow.
You know, he describes a scene where it was chaotic. In my movie, I actually have the moving footage, you know,
yeah.
the video footage that was taken. And someone swipes the frame, and then in this 1 second, when the frame becomes clear, Eddie's able to take that shot. And apparently, according to forensics, the photograph was taken at the precise moment that the bullet was in the man's head. It hadn't come out the other side, you know.
Man.
So in that case, Eddie would have said it was luck. It was the right timing, you know, as it was with Joe Rosenthal's, you know, raising of the flag, you know, that same photograph. That was timing. But I think, I think he must have had a feel for, you know, where to take the photograph from, how to, you know.
Right.
He showed emotion on people's faces up close. I think that's what differentiated Eddie, you know. It was his shots were up close and personal.
Mm-hmm. And I wasn't, of course I knew the photo, as everyone does. I didn't know the details of the story behind the photo, which is explored here, and why it was a shot that, while it made his work internationally renowned and known, it really tortured him, that shot.
It truly did.
That's an interesting story.
It truly did, because General Luan, who's the man holding the gun in the shot, he was actually a good man. He was actually our ally. And the man who's being killed had actually murdered a family just before then. And I think General Juan's emotions just got the better of him, and he just killed him. But by taking the photograph, Eddie did in fact help end the Vietnam War, but he was haunted by the fact that he destroyed General Juan's life, because he was vilified by that photograph. He was considered the bad guy around the world, you know. He came to epitomize the futility of war, the brutality of war.
Yeah.
And the poor man ended up running a pizza shop in Virginia, actually, when he did finally get out of Vietnam.
Yeah, and they encountered each other there, didn't they?
Yes.
Many years later.
You know, Eddie was tortured by the fact that he ruined his life, and he kept in touch with him. And there's a scene in my film where Eddie describes going into the bathroom and seeing a right of the pizza parlor, where the man is now very small and frail and obviously beaten down. And he describes in the bathroom there was written the words, "We know who you are, you effer." You know,
yeah,
on the wall of the bathroom.
Now, was he anxious? You met with him.
Yes.
While you were prepping this, was he anxious to tell his story? And did he want to set the record straight on something? What was his? Why was he so anxious to cooperate, or was he?
Oh, he was very, very anxious to cooperate. I think that. I think he was like all great artists, you know. I don't think Eddie ever felt that any of his work was good enough, you know.
Yeah.
It's strange. He took a series of pictures called The Boat of No Smiles, Mm-hmm. Where one day he just ran and jumped on a boat that was leaving Vietnam, and it was full of refugees, and these boats were getting plundered and sunk. And he took a bunch of wonderful pictures of these poor, desolate refugees. And because of those photographs, Congress changed their ruling and allowed 250,000 Vietnamese refugees into America.
Yeah.
And at the end of telling us about that, Eddie says, but, you know, I didn't mean to do it. I'm not a good guy. And I think those words just underline how tortured he was, like most artists, you know?
Yeah. But the movie... And probably the main reason why I love the movie as much as I do is because it really shows how an artist, in this case Eddie Adams, changes the world in his own way, changes
Absolutely.
Perception, brings about change. And that is also something I believe above any motion picture genre that the documentary can do as well.
Absolutely.
Is that what drew you to become a documentarian?
Absolutely. That's a wonderful question, because I became a documentarian for that very reason. I met this poor girl who'd been displaced by the Balkan War. Her mom
mm-hmm.
had died, and she was just suicidal when I met her. And
mm.
I said to her, I'm going to make a film about you, because I knew that if she was able to tell her story, and I took her back to Croatia while the fighting was going on and everything, I knew that if I did that, it would somehow be a catharsis for
mm-hmm.
her. It would
yeah.
help her. And I'm so happy to say that now she's very happy, very settled. I went to her graduation from college in June, and I'm like a surrogate mother, you know? I
yeah.
helped her through that process, and I think that's a microcosmic way that documentaries can make a difference. But, you know, they can make a difference in huge ways by bringing issues out into the foreground and
yeah.
raising people's awareness to change things.
There are documentaries, and more than anything else, I think that on the show we really champion the documentary form, and when we see a great documentary, we want to sing to the heavens about it.
Yes, we do.
And I'm wondering...
Well, bless you guys. Thank you.
Well, no, there's actually a site I just learned about last night called Snag Films, where you can watch new documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the new ways of distributing documentaries
yeah.
online now. But I'm wondering if there are any particular documentaries or filmmakers that have influenced you and your voice as a filmmaker.
Well, of course, the Maisel brothers, if I'm pronouncing them properly, the Maisel brothers, yes, very much. But
mm-hmm.
I tell you whose work I really love and whose career I'd like to emulate is Michael Apted, because
oh, yeah.
he travels between, you know, the narrative world and the documentary world, and I'd like to do the same thing. I mean,
yeah.
I remember... watching his 7-Up series, and then, you know, the
mm-hmm.
continuations of those, and I was just very moved by them.
I tell you, those
Jonathan
Demme
does that, too. He goes between documentaries
That's true.
And features, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that 7-Up series is,
yes.
talk about an artist, and what a great humanistic
oh,
kind of endeavor
yes.
that it's startling, that whole
but,
series.
Yeah.
That is just an earth-shattering series, taking the whole scope and everything. I mean, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
It's
Tell
amazing.
Me about...
yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it's amazing how you could almost... It was almost like a prophecy. You had these different children,
mm-hmm.
and at a young age, you could tell almost what their destiny was going to be like. But
yeah.
I also wanted to say that a documentary that I made 10 years ago about a cop from East L.A. who
mm-hmm.
is a wonderful man. His name is Sergio Villasenor, and he works in the worst area of East L.A. It's got 39 known gangs in a 3-mile radius. He took a bunch of kids out of a gang and turned them into a successful roller hockey team. And I'm actually going to direct the narrative feature of that documentary this year.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so I'm thrilled to death because the gang kids were at my house the other night with the cop and the writer, and we were all, you know, we're finishing up the script, and we're all so excited to be making it.
Oh, that is
exciting.
Wonderful. Wow.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Great.
Thank you.
Talking a little bit more about an unlikely weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have a lot of very high-profile people that you interview in this film.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what that process was and what were the highlights and what were the most intimidating kind of figures that you sat across from to interview in this one?
Well, strangely enough, when I'd done my documentary on the Balkan War, the first person I wrote to was Peter Jennings. And I said, you know, I've done this film because he was one of my heroes. He covered that war. And, of course, I never heard back from him. My DVD is probably sitting on a desk with all the other brilliant, quotes, unquote, unsolicited works, you know, of filmmakers. But I had to pinch myself when a few years ago I was sitting in a field at Eddie's workshop interviewing Peter Jennings, and he was such a pro. He would start a sentence and say, No, let me do it again because you need a more concise soundbite, you know. And I remember going into NBC Studios in Rockefeller Center and going to interview Tom Brokaw, and I was so nervous. I was terrified. And strangely enough, he was nervous because, you know, it's the opposite side for him. He's usually the interviewer.
Right.
And I said to him, you know, Tom, interviewing you is tantamount to interviewing God. And it sort of, he laughed, I laughed, and it broke the ice, and we were okay after that.
Yeah.
But it was really strange because Morley Safer was the same. He was a little nervous when I was interviewing him.
Huh.
You know, it's strange because usually they're so confident, these guys.
Yeah. I could see that dynamic at play though. That is something else. Also, something that I wanted to bring up. You have one of the great voices narrating this film. How did Kiefer Sutherland get on board?
Well, Kiefer's actually a friend of mine, and he's a man I have so much respect for because, apart from his 24 character, his character on 24, and all the nonsense that's written about him in the press, he is truly one of the most honorable men. He's an absolute gentleman, and when I asked him to do this, he didn't hesitate. He said, absolutely, you know?
Yeah, he is wonderful. And just a promo, 24... premieres tonight. Just to
in eight minutes, actually.
There you go.
That's
there
right.
You go.
8 minutes, so we'll get you to it, Jerry.
I'm all right. That's why they invented TiVo.
The reason I wanted Kiefer is because he's a bit of a renegade and a bit of a maverick, like Eddie. And
he is.
I wanted his voice because their characters are very similar. They do things their way, you know.
Right, right. Now, has this played in front of a large audience before? I know you guys are premiering at the Palm Springs International Film Festival, I believe, on the 14th.
Yes, the 14th and the 16th we're playing in Palm Springs. The 14th, that I think, at 4 o'clock. And, yeah, we've played all over the world. I mean, we've won 7 awards, I think, now, and it's so exciting to me because at first I thought, well, maybe I've made a film that photographers might be interested in or photography students, but it's got a much wider audience than that. It really seems to resonate with people, and I'm thrilled about that, actually. It's a big surprise to me. Yeah.
Oh, it's a wonderful film, and I loved it. And Susan, you're just delightful, and I want you to come back on the show anytime
you
want to talk about a future film or just talk about films in general. We'd love to have you back on.
I would love to. Thank you so much. Oh, and I also must say, Kyle Eastwood, who did my music, is up tonight for a Golden Globe with his dad. So keep your fingers crossed.
We are.
Oh, is that for Torino?
For Gran Torino, yes.
Oh, cool.
The title song. Yeah.
The only thing we love more than documentaries on the show are film composers. So we're excited about that.
Yes, we are.
About that
I'm
category,
keeping
definitely.
My fingers crossed because he's a lovely guy and very talented. He, along with Michael Stevens, composed the music, and it's great. It's really good.
Well, we will all keep our fingers crossed here too, and we thank you so much for joining us and enjoy the premiere on the 14th.
Bless you, I will, and thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you for being on, and good luck.
Take care.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That's Susan Morgan Cooper. The movie is An Unlikely Weapon, the Eddie Adams story. We've put the web address in the chat room there at unlikelyweapon.com.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can also purchase the film on the website
I think
it's a great movie. All right, 5 minutes out from 24 in the Golden Globes. It's a big night to stay
at
home.
Quite a night, yeah.
So we appreciate everyone joining us tonight, and we'll see you Wednesday night with another great show, Jerry. Thanks so much, buddy.
No problem. Thank you.
Give me a call during the award show if you want to talk about something.
I will, definitely. All right.
Good
night.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.